2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 1. Now it came to pass when the king, this is David, was dwelling in his house, and the Lord had given him rest from his enemies all around, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside tent curtains." Then Nathan said to the king, "Go and do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you." But it happened that night that the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, verse 5, "Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, would you build a house for me to dwell in? For I have not dwelt in a house since the time that I brought the children of Israel up from Egypt, even to this day, but have moved about in a tent and in a tabernacle. Wherever I have moved about with all the children of Israel, have I ever spoken a word to anyone from the tribes of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now therefore, thus shall you say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the sheepfold, from following the sheep, to be ruler over my people, over Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you, and have made you a great name, like the name of the great men who are on the earth. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel. I will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more, nor shall the sons of wickedness oppress them any more, as previously. Since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused you to rest from all your enemies, also the Lord tells you that he will make you a house. In verse 12, when your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever, according to all these words and according to all this vision. So Nathan spoke to David. And David, in verse 18 to the end of the chapter, was obviously absolutely blown away and floored, and said, "Who am I and my family, my house? Who is this people group? I don't. Why did you pick me? Why did you choose me? What does this mean exactly?" Well, the implications, I'm sure, by the time that David realized what was going on, was A, we read in 1 Chronicles 28 that David was being withheld from building God a temple. And it doesn't say it here, but that explanation was given either right after this or at a later date. John asked a question last week, and we went into 1 Chronicles 28. I can go there and it says, 1 Chronicles 28, then King David rose to his feet and said, "Hear me, my brother and my people. I had it in my heart," says verse 2 of chapter 28 of 1 Chronicles, "to build a house of the rest of for the ark of the covenant of the Lord and for a footstool for our God, and had made preparations to build it. But God said to me, 'You shall not build a house for my name, because you have been a man of war and have shed blood.'" Okay, so now, it would seem that this was said around the same time that of what we're reading in 2 Samuel. However, this is where it's mentioned. Prophets were the ones that compiled all of these history annals. And there are times where the stories are placed in different chronological order. However, most likely that was recorded at the same time. He was told, "No, you're not going to," because the Lord showed up to Nathan and said, you're not going to do this. This is not going to happen. But here's what this is what's going to take place. You know, I mentioned Rick Warren last week because the first line in that book, he just lays it out and says, it's not about you. And I'm going to read what he said, the first paragraph. The purpose of your life is far greater than your own personal fulfillment. Your peace of mind or even your happiness, it is far greater than your family, your career, or even your wildest dreams and ambitions. If you want to know why you were placed on this planet, you must begin with God. You were born by His purpose and for His purpose. So, if we just apply this, what Rick is saying as a principle to David. David, it's not about you. It's not about your career. It's not, your family is going to be, you're right in the middle of the plan of the Messiah, okay? The people group that's going to bring the Messiah onto the scene, your family is right in the middle of it, and I'm letting you in on how this is going to work. It's not like they negotiated. John brought this up last week. There wasn't a negotiation where God said, look, David, I tell you what, let's do some talking here about what we can work out. God just let David know, out of your line, okay, and it's going to look like this, and it's going to be an aeonian life. There is an everlasting aeonian, that's the Greek term. It will be something that transcends a normal kingdom. Some of these things were true with Solomon, and some of them were, you know, only could be fulfilled by the Messiah. And we'll get to where in the New Testament you saw that even the Pharisees recognized that that this is exactly what this passage was talking about. I think it's important that we notice that God didn't ask David to build the temple. And we know that, one, because the setup that he's telling Nathan before verse 14 in 2 Samuel 7, he goes through and says, now I took you from the sheepfold, I'll appoint a place for you, and he's talking about the tabernacle. Okay, well, in Acts chapter 7, when Stephen's just before Stephen gets rocks thrown at him and becomes the church's first martyr, Stephen just gives an absolutely masterful dissertation about the history of Israel. And part of what he gives is in Acts chapter 7, starting at verse 44, he says, our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as he appointed and instructed Moses to make it according to the pattern that he had seen, which our fathers, having received it, in turn also brought with Joshua into the land possessed by the Gentiles, whom God drove out from before the face of the fathers until the days of David. Okay, so Stephen's gone, and he's given all his history. Now he's up to the time of David, and he mentions the tabernacle and that God laid out the design for that, and now David comes on the scene. Verse 46, who found favor before God and asked to find a dwelling for the God of Jacob, but Solomon built him a house. Okay, so David asked. David didn't get to build it. God didn't. Stephen is very clear. David asked, but didn't build it. Moreover, the Most High does not dwell in temples made with hands, as the prophet says. Heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. What house will you build for me, says the Lord, and what is the place of my rest? Verse 50, has my hand not made all these things? Stephen's loosely quoting from Isaiah, the last chapter of the book of Isaiah, and the full quote goes like this. Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne, and my earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you will build for me, and where is the place of my rest? For all those things my hand has made, and all these things they exist, says the Lord, but on this I will look, on him who is poor, of a poor and contrite spirit, on and who trembles at my word. As in, the point is that the dwelling place of God wasn't the temple. Okay, the dwelling place of God is, thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you will build for me? And where is the place of my rest? In the people. That's what Isaiah is saying. It's stated as a question. If you look in those verses, there's a question mark behind each one. But I will look on those who have a poor and contrite spirit and who tremble at my word. Those who choose to honor me, those are the people. That is where I'm going to dwell with my people. We see that the Davidic covenant is the fulfillment of what in Genesis 49, as Jacob was talking and he was going down and he was prophesying, because these are the descendants of these kids. So he's going and he's prophesying over them. And he says to Judah in 49:9, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have grown up. He bows down, he lies down like a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. And it's a very clear picture of a messianic prophecy. Several of these things are true of Solomon. I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. Solomon did that. Rehoboam, those things were united, and then the kingdom was split. David was the uniter. It split under Rehoboam. But in 14, I will be his father and he shall be my son. The parallel in First Chronicles is, I will be his father, he shall be my son, and I will not take my mercy away from him as I took it away from him who was before you. As we're in 7:14 of 2 Samuel, it says, I will chase him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. Well, that never happened per se. Like, there was never a time where Jesus committed iniquity. However, the iniquity for us all was laid upon him, as it says in the book of Isaiah. So, did Solomon's reign, were there problems with Solomon's reign? Yes. So, some would say there wasn't a dual fulfillment. Some would say there was. The resources I used, they didn't. Some people just say that there is no such thing as a double fulfillment, and some do. I don't think it really matters. It's obviously taught. Both of those things were true in a way, but you can't push it out too far. But this was definitely taken by the Jews of the time, and then 1,000 years later as being messianic and being prophetic and the disciples. So, the places this is quoted in the New Testament, just as significant as it is, are many. I didn't write them all down, but I thought I would give you a taste of it. The first one is when Jesus was talking to the Pharisees, right? So it's always funny when a detractor, because Jesus was an absolute master of debate, whether it was using sarcasm or rhetoric, he absolutely commanded. There's never a recorded instance where they got one over on, on the Messiah, as it were. And, well, go figure, that would make sense, being as who he was. So, in Matthew 22, when the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, saying, "What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he?" And they said to him, "The son of David." Why would they say that? Well, they would say that because of what was in 2 Samuel. And he said to them, "How then does David in the Spirit call him Lord?" And Jesus opens up this argument by essentially saying, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." If David then calls him Lord, how is he his son? Talking about literally saying, okay, so positionally, how does this work with David and this? And they couldn't answer because that would be a real problem with their theology, essentially, is what it was. And verse 46, "And no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day on did anyone dare question him anymore." Because every time they would talk to him about these types of things, he would just shut it down and say, "Look, no, I'm not going to participate in this kind of, I'm going to shut you down. You know, I'm not going to allow you to," because there's always a larger audience when the Pharisees were gathered together. So they knew what that meant. Let's see, where else is it? The blind men in Matthew 9, when Jesus departed from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, "Son of David, have mercy on us." And so they're referring back to, they're basically calling Jesus the Messiah. So just picture for yourself that you've got an entire framework and structure that has no interest in a Galilean with no formal education and not on your side, the population calling him the Messiah. When you say, "Son of David, have mercy on us," you're saying, "You're the Messiah," is what they're saying. In Matthew 15, "And behold, a woman of Cana came from the region and cried out to him, saying, 'Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed.'" Just let you know the things that Jesus were doing at the time, people recognized as being a fulfillment of 2 Samuel. That's just that it was what it was. There was no doubt about who this guy was to the common people. And it's interesting when, you know, because you'll read that, and I've read by those things, and it comes, you say, oh, it's a familiar term, but then it's not one that we use in our vernacular. It's not one that our culture is familiar with. But instead, you look back at what they meant by that. "You're the God man. You're the Messiah." That's what they're saying as he's going by, and you realize that that's very polarizing for those that would disagree with that he was a direct threat. The blind man goes like this in the book of Matthew. And I just like the story, and I'll read the whole thing because it gives you the flavor. "And Jesus called to them, to himself, and said, 'You know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them.'" This is Matthew 20, 25. "And those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant." Now go back and remember how many times God was talking to David, "My servant David." And then David would say, "But Lord, you know your servant." Okay, their relationship, God had recognized what his relationship was with David, and David recognized his relationship with God. Okay, but David was the king, as far as people were concerned, but the language that Jesus is using here, "And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Now they went out to Jericho, a great multitude followed him. And here's the and then the story goes like this. And behold, two blind men were sitting on the road. They heard that Jesus was passing by and cried out, saying, "Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." Then the multitude warned them that they should be quiet. Okay, and so you may have heard sermons over the years of why or whatever, and I have no idea why they did that. They were being annoying. They were drawing attention to the fact that they were eating up his time. I do like the part where the multitude shushed them. Okay, so they shushed blind people. And they cried out all the more, "Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." So Jesus stood still and called them and said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Lord, that our eyes should be opened," may be opened. And the Lord had compassion on them and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes perceived sight, and they followed him. So instantaneously, there was no misunderstanding about what had just transpired. They couldn't see, now they could. Now they knew who to follow because they got to see who touched their eyes, right? Kind of neat the way that's in the New Testament, we're called the temple, our bodies. We're is it 1 Peter 2? Yeah. First Peter Chapter 2, coming to him as a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious, you also as living stones are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices. And that's kind of the idea of us being an inhabited place for God, that God doesn't dwell in houses made with stone, that one physical location doesn't have more virtue or is more holy than another per se, that all of the people that choose to become God's servant and surrender their will to him become a vessel to carry him. And it's just that simple. And that's laying it out that way, picking the language. That was kind of that exchange between David and God and Nathan, and he's trying to let him know, I didn't ask you to build this thing, but it's going to happen. And we didn't say thank you, but the point was, I appreciate your gesture. I'm going to do something. I'm going to let you in on what's going to happen, and it's going to be from your line the Messiah will come. And it was, like I said, it was very significant because that's exactly what happened. And Jesus was from the line of David, from both of his parents. Both of his parents were from that Achillean line. David had a huge family. He had lots of wives and lots of kids, and some ruled, some didn't. And Ephesians 2 is at another place where the apostle goes and talks about what our dwelling place is, and he says, 17, and he came and preached peace to you who are afar off and to those who are near, for through him we have both access by one Spirit to the Father. Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building being fitted together grows into a holy temple of the Lord, in whom you are also being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. And so that entire concept is what I was attempting to explain. He just laid it out in building terms. You have this building, and you got the chief cornerstone that keeps everything upright, and then the foundation is laid by all of us, and you are the dwelling place of the God in the Spirit, in whom you are part of this building. And that's been true for 2,000 years now. That's what we are. And In closing, Peter, in the book of Acts, when Peter was giving his initial impromptu dissertation, his first message, he said, in 29, men and brethren, let me speak freely with you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him, that of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ to sit on his throne. There you go. And so, Peter, post crucifixion, resurrection, walks out there in a group of people and says, hey, listen, okay, this is the way this is set up. It was set up this way, and about 3,000 people heard that message and were baptized that day. And so we will continue through Samuel. Questions, comments? Mr. I don't think anywhere in the New Testament encourages us to lift up anything physical or temporal above another. I don't read of anywhere where it says, okay, you're supposed to, like when he says honor one day above another, it's all the same. This food, it's all equal. Now there's no circumcision, non-circumcision, all of those things, there's no virtue, I guess, in any of it. I guess that's how we're supposed to. From what I understand of the New Testament, that's how we're supposed to interact with what goes on. However, I think for individuals, a point of release for their faith in a place they feel safe, in a room of a certain color, and you could go down the list. Some of that's psychological, but point being. Like you said, fellowship hall versus sanctuary. Well, we don't talk in the sanctuary. We do our visiting elsewhere. That was not the standard in the early church. I guarantee you that was not the standard when Jesus was here, because it was outside at the lake. It was in somebody's house. It was in a synagogue, which was just a meeting place. There was no standard, and it seems like whether it was healing or preaching or wherever it was, there was nothing formulaic. And I guess I feel like that's what we're supposed to avoid. However, you look back at the history of the church, and you look at the Greek Orthodox versus the Roman, and you have you can have an iconoclastic icon if it's flat. No, we can have it if it's carved. And they got in a fight over, you can have pictures, but you can't have carvings, essentially. They had a fight over that, right? One was an image, one was an idol, and one wasn't. And so that's the point, is when it gets to the point where we're putting a snake up and we're calling it Nehushtan, it's a thing of brass, when it becomes a problem like that, people see, we can only do this in the sanctuary, or we can only, we got to set the tent up and then we can start laying hands on people. When I think when it goes there, that's too far. Right. I don't think that's meant. I don't read a prescription. Maybe somebody else. I don't ever see a prescription in the New Testament for that.